What you're saying, just to be clear here, is that if you're in a filibuster world and you need 10 Republican votes, you're saying there's not 10 Republican votes to raise the wage.
Let me be very clear about this. The only way that we are going to raise the minimum wage is through reconciliation or ending the filibuster. In my view, I do not see in the foreseeable future getting significant support from Republicans.
Yes, it is Friday, February 26, 2021. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, otherwise known as unemployed Trump staffer, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Everybody, you're saying we have a little kind of technical issue here. Sean, how's the level sound right now? All right, good. Sorry about that, everybody. But just wanted to kind of double check and make sure we're coming through. Fantastic. So we are streaming live on our YouTube channel right now. So if you guys are over there, people kind of coming in, make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you like this episode during the episode and hit that bell to make sure that you are notified every single time that we go live. On today's show, Democrats who have been lukewarm about passing a $15 an hour minimum wage got the cover they needed yesterday as the Senate parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough advised that the $15 an hour minimum wage cannot be included in a reconciliation package. Remember, that's where all the hopes have been placed. Those Democrats who have been pushing for the $15 an hour minimum wage have urged that Vice President Harris overrule the parliamentarian's ruling, which is within her authority, by the way. And on Twitter, Representative Ro Khanna, for example, wrote, quote, "I'm sorry, an unelected parliamentarian does not get to deprive 32 million Americans the raise that they deserve. This is an advisory, not a ruling. VP Harris needs to disregard the rule, and a $15 hour minimum wage is in order." Yeah, it's time to dump the filibuster, it seems. And as David Dayan argued this morning, it's time to put the $15 an hour minimum wage bill on the floor. Start exacting some political costs for this one. And while the Biden administration and conservative Democrats are willing to throw up their hands and say that there's nothing that they can do when it comes to the minimum wage, they're willing to roll out the tanks in support of Neera Tandem's appointment to the Office of Management and Budget. Because, like, that's what Americans really want. And release the hawks. Biden orders airstrikes in Syria against two Iranian-backed militia on the border with Iraq. The administration claims to have targeted and destroyed multiple facilities located at the border control point that is used by a number of Iranian-backed militant groups. The strikes were said to be in response to recent attacks on American contractors and properties in Iraq by militants. Looks like there's going to be some neocons are going to be happy. And the pandemic rages on. Even as cases finally begin to drop and the vaccine starts to roll out, the U.S. passed 500,000 COVID-19 deaths this week. And there was some research that came out and that showed that if the United States had done what North Korea did, that our death toll right now would be 10,000 instead of 500,000. And a new report published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences warns that the Atlantic Meridional overturning circulation, or AMOC, AMOC, the sea currents, that is the kind of like the sea currents that kind of takes warm air from kind of the center and kind of up kind of the North Atlantic into the North Atlantic. Well, they're slowing down faster than expected. And that may lead to a tipping point in climate change if swift action is not taken. Scientists have warned that the slowing or stopping of the AMOC will lead to large-scale impacts affecting life on the planet. And New York City police deployed Boston Dynamics' creepy and frankly dystopian robot dog to a live crime scene this week. The New York Post released footage of the robot dog being released to a home invasion scene in the Bronx. It wasn't the first time either. Back in October, the NYPD sent another robot dog into a building where a gunman had barricaded himself. According to the Post, the robot dog is in its test phase, equipped with only lights and a camera. No guns yet. Quote, this robot dog is able to use its artificial intelligence to navigate things very complex environment, according to NYPD's Technical Assistance Response Units, Deepu John. Yeah, what could go wrong with that? A little closer to home, the Delaware River Valley Commission lifted their moratorium and has banned fracking in the Delaware River watershed. Yes. This will protect the drinking water for tens of millions of residents living in New York, New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. And the Pennsylvania House and Senate Republicans threw a temper tantrum this week after the Department of State released their ballot question on a constitutional amendment limiting the governor's powers on emergency declaration orders. Apparently, the question was too straightforward and not confusing enough for Republicans. And Kendra Brooks from Philly City Council is joining Astra Taylor from the Debt Collective and calling bullshit on Biden's claim that he can't cancel $50,000 in student loan debt. And of course, Pennsylvania Republicans failed to cancel Pat Toomey after spending hours debating his vote to convict Donald Trump. Wah, wah, wah.
I'm doing the best I can.
In today's last call, the Mars Perseverance rover sent back amazing footage of the February 18th landing in Jezero Crater. Just really absolutely amazing. A couple of days later, we got the first full-color 360-degree view of what Perseverance sees. Gotta admit it, I was in awe. I forgot to put this in our show notes, or Sean could see, but also we've got the announcement this week that in 2025, construction will begin on a private, for-profit, artificial gravity hotel in space. I'll tell you more about that in today's last call. They rolled out the demo a couple weeks back, or last week, so that's pretty crazy. Anyways, a Columbia County woman right here in PA, right, becomes one of NASA's newest flight directors. Chloe Mehring grew up in Mifflinburg and started working with NASA in 2008 as a Flight Operations Propulsion Systems Group. And researchers are making a case that NASA should begin studying nuclear propulsion systems for future Mars missions. I think it's going to be piloted by robot dogs. And put that six-pack back in the cooler. Molson Coors Beverage Company has locked out 300 workers in its Toronto brewery after workers overwhelmingly rejected the company's best and final offer during contentious contract negotiations. Molson Coors had prepared for this move by posting ads for scab workers three weeks before their lockout. I got to give a shout out to my friend Niels, who kind of sent me that one. Sean has whiskey recommendations. And he'll tell us a little about the photos, which are probably going to come in a box in the middle of this podcast. Maybe he'll show them to you. And today's Free Will releases Sputnik 36. It is a dry Irish stout brewed with a base of flaky barley, roasted barley, and midnight wheat. Coming in at 4.3 ABV. We'll talk a little about that one. And this is their big news this week. The first ever Ralphius Alternative Bourbon Barrel Aged Stout is now available. Well, it'll be available Saturday. I cannot speak. Tomorrow at both Perkasie and Peddler's Village tap rooms. And it's also going to be sending out to online stores in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and D.C. These are these little 8.4-ounce cans, but there's a reason why they're 8.4 ounces. This thing called Soul Supper, the Imperial Age Stout and Bourbon Barrels, were chilies, cacao nibs, cinnamon, cumin, star anise, and milk sugar. It comes in at, are you ready for this? 13.5 ABV. We'll talk a little bit about that. Anyways, we'll tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV, this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. Also, tune on the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. And make sure to subscribe to Rick Smith Show's daily podcast on iTunes, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. And man, you can tune in to some of the upcoming Out the Coop Lives. Man, I hope we had a great turnout for Jordan Hopkins. We had him on Wednesday. It was a special Wednesday edition of Out the Coop Live. Freaking amazing conversation. His work is phenomenal. It gave me so much hope talking to him about the future of kind of progressive left media. And, you know, it's been a long time since I've heard, like, you know, someone who's doing that kind of work have such a commitment to building out networks, right, of progressive and kind of left kind of media folks and doing that kind of mutual aid thing. And we've been talking about that at Raging Chicken forever. So that's absolutely fantastic. But his work studying kind of, you know, PA extremists and the kind of the grift at the core of the Patriot Party is phenomenal. So check out that Out to Coop Live. That was from Wednesday. This coming Monday, that's March 1st at 7 p.m., I'm welcoming Sean O'Leary, a senior researcher with the Ohio River Valley Institute. We're going to be talking about the Institute's new report, Appalachia's Natural Gas Counties, the Natural Gas Fracking Boom, and Appalachia's Lost Economic Decade. That will be both in our Podbean app as a live call-in and on our YouTube channel. Perfect timing, especially given what just happened with the banning fracking in the Delaware River Basin. That's phenomenal. And, you know, we made the announcement on Wednesday, but I want to also, I'm very, very excited about this. On Monday, March 8th, also at 7 p.m., both on Podbean and on our YouTube channel, I'm welcoming State's Representative Elizabeth Fiedler and State Senator Nikhil Saval. We're going to be on the show talking about the people's budget and progressive organizing, the growing of the, I remember this, I think I first talked about, we used this term back when I talked to Rick Kajewski back in the fall, but the growing of the Pennsylvania squad to the Pennsylvania battalion of the progressive left within the state house, which is freaking amazing. So definitely tune in on that March 8th. You'll see more announcements of that coming here. And a special huge shout out to our newest patrons, Brian and Jude. Yes, both Brian and Jude, they each came in with their became patrons at the $5 a month level. Thank you so much for joining up. Thank you so much because it's all your support and everyone like you, everyone who supports this show, what makes it all possible. And for all your gamers out there, I just want to give a shout out to the folks at the Game Inn. That's the Game Inn with two N's, located right on Route 309 in Quakertown. Game Inn is a Quakertown-based, black family-owned gaming store. They're friends of the show and awesome folks all around. And not only that, they're personal friends. One of my son's best friends' family owns it. It's a phenomenal place. It has almost every gaming product you can imagine. Retro N64s, Nintendo DSs, PS4s, and Switches. They got video games for all platforms, large collection of collectibles, including action figures and Funko Pops, and the kids get a discount with every A on the report card. You can't beat it. Check them out on their Facebook page. Follow them on Twitter at @TheGameIn with two N's. If you've got a question about a game, looking for something hard to get, message them on Facebook. You see a link in the show notes for today. Drop them an email at thegameinpa@gmail.com or give them a call, 267-424-2535. Check out their webpage at thegameinn.com. That's thegameinn with two N's.com. And we want a progressive future. Man, we need progressive media. Support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today, becoming a patron of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Do what Brian and Jude did this week. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and become a patron today. We got rid of Trump, and now the hard work of building a progressive future begins. We're here for the fight, and we need you. Become a patron for the price of a good beer once a month. Help keep the media in the movement in the media. Become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/rcpress. Or give us a one-time donation by going to paypal.me/rcpress, and you can do that right now. And don't forget, smash that subscribe button if you're watching on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to our channel. Make sure you hit that bell so you know we go live. Our goal is to try to get to 100 subscribers in the next couple days. If we can get over that 100 level, I'd be so freaking happy. So get on over there, subscribe to our channel, and share it with your friends. Here we go. Sean, man, I feel like that was an exhausting beginning to the show. I'm sorry for like the technological stuff. I've got a glitch somehow in in what's the sound that's feeding into the channel, and it's cut me off. So I don't know. So I went from being like enraged at stuff at the minimum wage stuff before we got on the show, and now I'm just got flustered with the tech stuff.
Well,
so.
I mean, we're back to normal now.
Yeah,
like we're. We have Democrats folding on popular initiatives like the $15 minimum wage. We're bombing. We're going back to the Obama years with drone strikes. You know, we're back to normal.
Yeah, that's what I feel like. I mean, when I saw it, I'll say, you know, it was
the honeymoon
funny.
Is over. It's normal.
Well, I you know what's really interesting is that after the strikes in the strikes in Syria. I just watched a couple of, you know, say news coverage of it, both on MSNBC and CNN, just to kind of see, and you could tell that they were like,
this feels so much better. We could talk about U.S. We could talk about Islamic militants and the U.S. bombings. This is great.
I was watching MSNBC highlights earlier this week. I think like Joe Scarborough had someone on from the Council of Foreign Relations, basically saying it's an embarrassment. Like, we should be looking at Afghanistan as a long-term investment and not as a, you know, permanent war. It's just like, you fucking neocons. Like, this is what we're back to. This is, you know, we're back to the same issues that got us to where we're at in the first place. At least, like, we had finally admit the F-35 was a disaster this week.
Well, that's something, good. Right?
Yeah, $1 trillion fucking boondoggle for the military-industrial complex.
Well, the, you know, the good thing, though, at least, you know, if they're going to start, like, you know, the bombing campaigns and stuff like that, it's, you know, then at least some of the folks from the Lincoln Project will get, you know, fall on their feet, and they'll be able to kind of find a position in the Biden administration since that grift was a complete disaster.
Yeah. So, I mean, but, other than that.
Yeah, so I, for me, like I said, when we first got on this morning before the show, I'm absolutely livid this morning about what's going on with the minimum wage, about the $15 hour minimum wage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this gives cover to Sinema, gives cover to Manchin for not having to pass it. They don't have to lift a finger. They don't do anything about the filibuster. You know, it's the best thing. It's the best of like all worlds for like Manchin and Sinema. And it's like, we're really going to let two people in the Senate take us hostage over the next 2 years and cost us the majorities in the House and the Senate. And then, you know, like, fuck us over for the 2024 election. Like, the whole entire like thing right now is like, we have to go big as possible, because like, if the Republicans retain the House, they will be able to block a Democrat from winning the election.
That's right.
In 2024. Like, and it's just amazing that like, the Democrats, the shit that's been saying this week, like Axelrod and Durbin saying we need Republicans to vote for this bill. No, you don't. Like, this bill is 80% popularity with the country and the nation. Let the Republicans have to deal with that shit themselves if they don't want to vote for it.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
And if they don't vote for it, like, let them explain why they didn't vote for it. And, you know, yeah, there's some pork spending in this, but you know what? Defend that, you know. Pork spending. Okay, the money's going towards infrastructure projects that are needed. Okay. Like, what's the big deal? Construction projects bring money into local economies. It's added value to your local market. Like, who gives a fuck if it's in there or not?
No, exactly. It's like, if you give like half a rat's ass about the you know, about the economy and getting people back to work and things like this, that's not kind of like bad pork, right? That's kind of like stuff that's actually going to kind of put some people to work and stuff. I mean, but I mean, look, for me, the bigger issue here is like, if you watch like the rollout, right, the lead up to this parliamentarian decision, right? So one, the parliamentarian's decision is kind of was elevated to like, you know, the, you know, like you've got the monk on the mountain. Right, we've got to go. We got to wait to hear from the monk on the mountain to see whether or not that this is going to be holy or not. Right. And they got really built up. Right. And the way that the Biden administration had been talking about this parliamentarian decision was very much like, you know, this is going to make or break it. And they started signaling, right, you know, again, first in private and then in public, that they didn't think that this really had a chance of passing. You had Ron Klain that was kind of sent out to the cameras and kind of on the cable news ahead of this, basically signaling like, well, look, we're going to respect the parliamentarian.
We have to respect the powers of the institution, you know, because Republicans will never bend the rules to their liking when given the opportunity to pass through stuff like this, you know, because.
And so basically what they're saying,
people.
Right. And they're saying to every American who's been hurting and has been like trying to live on freaking like $7 like an hour, right? You know, or, you know, I mean, like, you gotta be kidding me. And they're basically saying, well, because of a technicality and because we don't think it's good, you know, it's a good look, the optics of kind of like, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris going in and kind of like saying, no, sorry, we're doing this anyways. You know, we disagree with your thing and we're going to put this in reconciliation bill, that the optics wouldn't be so good. So you're going to basically saying, you know, F you to every single person out there who's kind of relying upon the minimum wage, relying and hoping to be able to kind of dig themselves out of poverty. No, we're not going to do that. That is the worst possible message that you could be given to the American people.
If Democrats lose 2022, it'll be because of this right here.
Absolutely.
I
agree 100%.
Like it's amazing. We are so great at self-sabotage our own fucking movements. And you know, the honeymoon's over at this point. Like if you don't have the will to do this, then like, you know, fuck you people.
And look, on a purely political level here too as well, just like internally.
And also like millions of Americans don't give a fuck about parliamentarian maneuvers in a minoritarian legislative body.
Exactly. And, you know, look, like so many of us, right, throughout our lives, right, have been disciplined, right, by, you know, by the technicalities, right? We've been told that it's not possible. This is the language of there is no alternative. There's nothing we can do. It is the language of cynicism. It is the practice of cynicism. And that is precisely like what is going to drive people out of politics, right? I mean, again,
Like have them vote for a fascist, populist, exactly. Like the next one that comes around.
Exactly. Now I'll say this. Now I've said I might have said this on the show like a couple times before, is that I'm telling you is that what all Trump had to do, if Trump was a more competent fascist, right? All he had to do to win that election was to basically say to legalize weed, right, and to drop a $15 hour minimum wage. If he had done those two things,
shown some fucking remorse around the COVID.
He didn't even need to do that. Like, I'm telling you, I don't even think he needed to do that.
I don't even think he had to go that far, $15 hour minimum wage. All he had to do was send people one-time checks November.
Or checks. That's it,
like,
right?
Back in September with his name on it. And then and also just show an ounce of remorse and respect for the 300,000 people that died at that time. Like, that's all he had to do was the bare fucking minimum. And yeah, he wasn't
– exactly.
And he couldn't acknowledge that.
Like, and this is what scares me, right? I mean, because that was that – look, because if you remember, go back – what happened in 2016, right? I mean, again, there were so many things that went wrong and were bad in that situation. But let me just highlight one, is that he was running to the left rhetorically, right? We talked about this a lot on the show. Running to the left rhetorically of Hillary Clinton when it came to trade. Right. And when it came to the working class, he spoke kind of about like, you know, working people. Right. And that's what he did. And if he had just made a small like move in that direction to make good on that rhetoric, right, he would have won. And this is a huge setup. If the Democrats are going to repeat this problem again, that the problem that they have, they're going to rely upon technicalities and we're going to throw up our hands and say there's nothing we can do because of the monk on
the filibuster.
Right. Well, yeah, well, exactly. Well, and this is what, you know, this is what is next, right? And I think that, look, the difference between now and 2016, the difference between now and even 2008 when Obama took office, right, is that you've got a kind of a left that is rising, right? You've got, I think people are a lot more clear-eyed. You've got a new generation of activists that you know, basically came to political consciousness working on Bernie Sanders campaigns, right, working with the DSA, working with kind of like, you know, organizations on the ground. I think those folks are pretty clear-eyed, right? If you look at the stuff that's coming out with PA Stands Up, for example, right here in Pennsylvania, right? There was no kind of like, oh, great, now we can wait for Biden to do it. No, right? I think that
it's now you have to deliver for us.
Right, exactly. And that is kind of precisely what, so that's the good news, right? The good news is that the organizations on the ground are much more clear-eyed, right? And there's actually
I'm looking forward to progressives to carpet bomb West Virginia and Arizona in ads attacking Sinema and Manchin on this stuff and like using this as leverage against them at this point. Like, okay, you're not going to do it. We'll form a pack. We'll form a super pack, and then we'll just blast the airwaves and use accountability measures against you and force you to do this.
Like, I would be putting on politicians from all the surrounding states, right, that are for the $15 minimum wage, like two as well, and just be saying like, you know, other Democrats, you've got Sherrod Brown, you get on kind of like, you know, even
every
Casey.
Democrat from Pennsylvania.
Yep. I mean,
supports.
Yep,
the $15 minimum wage.
Yep, and say like Pennsylvania, like what do Pennsylvania lawmakers say about the, you know, Democrats say about this? Yes, our people deserve this. Our people deserve this. What does Joe Manchin say? No. Right?
Like, does Joe Manchin really want to go down as being the person who
apparently
destroyed, like just put the final nail in American democracy?
I mean, that's the direction he's going.
Yeah. Just, yeah, I mean, like that seems like that's what he wants to be remembered for. And it's like there has to be pressure campaigns against these people. Like, one of the things, you know, this week with Manchin, you know, as horrible as a human being that Neera Tanden is, and she acted over the past several years, like, we cannot let Manchin get away with this stuff because it only embolden him and empower him even more. Like, and that, you know, like, and the same thing, like, well, Sinema, not that much of a problem. Manchin, yes. I mean, Manchin was even signaling his issues with Deb Haaland, you know, yeah, as Interior Secretary. Like,
he can go to hell, like, man. I tell you.
You know, we have to send a clear message that he is not to be, like, they can't be doing this. Like, you know what I mean?
Well, look, this is, you know, David Dayen kind of telegraphed this yesterday. Basically before the parliamentarian had made this kind of, you know, whatever you want to call it, an advisory ruling or whatever it might be. Right. Let's be clear. What a parliamentarian is, right, is the one that kind of, they look at the rules and they interpret the rules kind of as they see fit. Right. And here's one of the problem is that she said, because there's this bird rule, right, that basically says that in reconciliation, this has to have an impact on the budget. Now, the Office of Management Budget, you know, they did the kind of independent analysis of the minimum wage stuff, and they either there's a conservative version and there is a kind of more liberal version of the impact on the budget. Both say they're going to impact the budget. The ruling from the Republican appointed OMB folks, what they said was that yes, it's going to add to the deficit. Right. So they, you know, they're looking at it as kind of a negative impact. Right. But there's economists on the other side of this. Right. They're looking at, no, this is actually going to bolster revenue because people are going to making more. So it's going to have tax revenue is going to come in. In either one of those readings, there's an impact on the budget. And the reconciliation process is all about saying you can only introduce stuff as part of reconciliation that has an impact on the budget. And so, yes, there's a disagreement over what exactly the impact is, but both the left and the right are in agreement on this, that it'll impact the budget. So what the parliamentarian had to do to rule this out is basically make a judgment to say this has an insignificant impact on the budget. Right? It's a judgment call. It's a value call. It's not something that is written in the rules. Right. So she had to come to that conclusion on her own. This is why Vice President Kamala Harris can easily come in here and say, no, look, there's an impact on both. We disagree with the parliamentarian's ruling on this. Right. These are the reasons why both the kind of Republicans and Democrats have talked about this as impacting the budget. That clearly falls within the grounds of a reconciliation, that we are going to keep this in the bill and pass it on a 51 person vote and make the fight about that. You want to fight about process? There's how you fight about process. Right. Process doesn't mean
stuff about.
Yeah. Okay. Process. I was just saying, process doesn't mean that when somebody tells you that, like, they disagree with you, that you just give up and you throw your hands in the air and cite technicalities and let people freaking starve. That is not how you do politics.
You know, and the thing about this is, like, we're going to really, like, you know, like, looking at 2 years of just doing nothing at this point. If we're not going to pass our initiatives, you know, like the Equality Act that was passed yesterday in the House, that's not going to get passed in the Senate, you know, right. Like because of the filibuster. Like, are we really going to let this stuff sit because of the filibuster and do nothing for 2 years that can have a direct, meaningful impact on people's lives?
Well, Sean, the filibuster is, like, you know, is a Senate norm and rule. And, you know, we have to respect that, even though it was put in place in order to maintain racist policies within, and was brought up by the architect of the Confederacy, Calhoun, who instituted the filibuster in order to prevent, you know, the South from having to kind of give up its racist ways. But it's been part of the Senate now, so we need to respect that.
You know, if we want to change the filibuster rules, we should go back to the old filibuster rules where people have to, you know, actually stay on the floor and speak for hours on end to stop something.
Yeah, I mean, people don't realize that, right? I mean, a lot of people don't realize that. Like, when you have the, filibuster, what they mean is, like, it's an email. You have one senator sends an email, said, yeah, I'm going to filibuster. I need to go get myself a taco. I need to go sit down and have a couple, like, you know, two-drink lunch at a swanky hotel. Right? So here's my email. I don't feel like coming in. I'm going to filibuster this. That's all it takes right now. They don't have to defend it. They don't have to argue for it. They don't have to do anything. And so there's, I mean, it's got, at the very least, I would say just get rid of it. Number two, if you have to reform it, you reform it. Say, okay, you get like 48 hours. And then after that, the threshold of kind of number of votes starts to come down. Right? It's a rule. It's nowhere in the Constitution. Like I said, it's history as is in order to preserve white supremacy, right? And serve the South and those kind of like minority white districts. That's what it's from. And so what is it that we're holding on to, Joe Biden? What is it that we're holding on to, freaking Joe Manchin, right? I mean, even Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was kind of opposed to ending the filibuster. I think Bernie Sanders is like, nope. Now he's like, okay, we're done with that. But I don't know, man. I'm livid about this. Because yeah. I was gonna say this before, and I think that even at the pure political level here, what the Democrats are signaling now to the Republicans is that we're gonna roll over. Right? We are not gonna fight, right? We're only gonna fight within these kind of like very narrow rules. Right? We're gonna fight over Neera Tandem, right? And we're gonna go to the mat for her, right? And like you said, I'm not a fan of hers at all, right? But there's an argument, say, no, you're gonna fight to preserve the cabinet thing. Sure. But you're gonna find to go public and say we're gonna fight over this. And like nobody in this country gives a rat's ass, right, about Neera Tandem. Only people who are closely following politics does that even matter to. For everyday people, what matters to them is their freaking like their jobs, their health, the future of their country. And instead, you're going to put on a show about fighting for this procedural thing about a cabinet appointee, which is so removed from most people's daily lives. Yet the thing that you have right in your front of you about a $15 an hour minimum wage is going to impact every single freaking American. What do you do with that? What they go, oh, sorry, nothing we can do. Couldn't he just say, oh, Neera Tandem? Well, look, Joe Manchin said he's not going to do it. Well, there's nothing we can do. Joe Manchin has said, so therefore there's nothing we can do. Next, who's up next? It's sick. It's sick. Anyways, I might even do, I've been playing around with this about even doing a reading of a part or discussion of David Dayan's piece a little bit more further. But I mean, I strongly recommend you check out David Dayan's piece. That's at the American Prospect. Look under the first 100. It's his newsletter. I would strongly recommend signing up for it too as well. It's fantastic, and he's got a piece that came out today. Let me just read just kind of a couple pieces of this, and then we'll move on from this because I know that we got more stuff to get to here today. Here's the beginning of his piece. As we know that the minimum wage hike produces changes in outlays and revenues as the Congressional Budget Office, I'm sorry, I said OMB, I meant CBO, my fault. Congressional Budget Office confirmed earlier this month. What McDonough had to rule on was to put the provision out of order under the Byrd rule is that those changes were, quote, merely incidental to the non-budgetary components of the provision, unquote. In other words, she had to read the mind of a legislation to decide what parts of it are incidental and what parts are primary. That's where we're at in America. It's a stupid process that's only necessary because a handful of Democrats refuse to overturn another stupid process, the filibuster and a minority rule. So they shoehorn the only legislating they can get done in a polarized Senate into a plainly inappropriate mechanism meant to resolve differences between the federal budget and public policy. How democracies die may sound like may sound hyperbolic, but yeah, this would be the path. Right. And he also mentions in here is that she may not be done ruling. Right. There are provisions right now that are also maybe on the chopping block, which has to do with a child tax credit. Right. That is there. And there is, along with some of the boost to the Affordable Care Act exchanges, that also may go from the wayside if she decides along the same lines. Right. So let's be clear. The Senate is already, right, a kind of minority rule body. right? In other words, the senators and the Republican senators who make up kind of 50% of the Senate represent, I forget the exact figures, a significantly fewer number of people than the Democrats who do, right? And that's the way that body has been set up. So the filibuster gives an added boost to minority rule, right, in the Senate. That's what this has been about. And that's what Dayan is talking about. So he's I would strongly recommend taking that up. No, I'm taking a peek at that. Anyways, sorry to go on about that, Sean. I'm really freaking livid about this.
Oh no, it's you're good.
Oh man. So I don't know, where do we go from here? I'm all flustered now. We talk about COVID deaths. We talk about the death of the climate. Like, what do you mean?
Let's go. Yeah, the dog. That dog that was.
Is that freaking crazy?
That's fucking insane.
So if
it shows you how mm-hmm. insane New York, the NYPD is when it comes to just surveillance. Like,
yep,
they have taken this surveillance stuff, the security state, like completely over the edge.
Right.
And that's all I gotta say. I mean, like, you're gonna use it to overpolice black and brown neighborhoods. Send that to Philadelphia. We'll show you how we treat robots.
Well, that's exactly it. I was like, you know, look, first of all, if you've ever seen the videos of those of those robot dogs, they're from Boston Dynamics. They're both like absolutely fascinating and absolutely horrifying. Right. Because they literally look like something out of, you know, one of these sci-fi movies go wrong. There's a Martian. I forget which Mars one it is. Right. It's called like Mars Dawn or something like this. Maybe I can't remember which one of the Mars movies it is. But there's a robot rover. Right. That looks freakily kind of close to what this is, a little bit more beefed up and Terminator looking, things like this. But that gets sent to Mars to help out. But it's a former military grade robot that kind of like, you know, has a short circuit and goes berserk and all that kind of stuff. But that's what this reminds me of. And the fact that you've got police units and military units are some of the first people that are looking at them to use them is pretty freaking startling. Because, you know, I mean, how long is it going to take? I mean, right now they have an arm that they can attach to this thing so it can open doors and things like this. So how long is it going to be before they decide, well, how can you outfit this with stun guns, right? Or, you know, non-lethal rounds, right? I mean, how long is that going to be? And we already kind of bombed the world with drones. I mean, how long is it going to take to start deploying that stuff on our own people? Well, the New York PD is leading the way once again. Right. I mean, the only plus side of what they're doing is that by sending the dog into a kind of a situation like that, there's less likelihood that the cop is going to kill somebody. So I guess like in the short term, that's a win. I don't know. I don't even know, man. The other thing that got me really disturbed this week, I mean, beyond the $500,000 in COVID-19 deaths, which is just wrapping my head around that is insane. But it's also this new report that came out in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, looking at how these kind of sea currents are slowing down kind of faster than would have thought. You know, and we just lost 4 years, right? At least in this country. Lost 4 years in terms of climate mitigation and kind of and bold action on this. And I believe it's already having kind of an effect in what we can see in terms of the impact on, on those currents. Those currents go down.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like these currents go down, like it's going to plunge Europe into an ice age.
Oh, exactly. And they're talking like about, right. I mean, because basically what that does, it brings the warm air kind of up the coast of the U.S., right, and then kind of up to kind of say England and Ireland and things like that. So it keeps that kind of as a fairly kind of, you know, keeps the climate fairly, you know, moderate compared to kind of what you might get in some of the other areas. But if you shut that off, right, then basically all that kind of warm air, all that kind of warm current begins to drop off. Right. And if that's ice age up there, you're talking about severe droughts are going to be brought to the United States, impacting food service. I mean, it's like, you know, again, you go read that report if you want to be happy. Let me put it that way. Right? I mean, it's but I mean, all the more reason. It's like, you know, I wanted to include that in gangs. If you remember before, before we got completely lost in the Trump era, I mean, we were covering this stuff kind of fairly regularly and we need to
at least our race for space will save us.
Well, yeah, totally. I'm all on board with that, man.
I can tell. You're putting all the marbles in that basket.
Yeah, no, we could talk. We, if you want to have a serious conversation about that, we can. But I know you don't, so I won't. I don't think it's going to save us at all. No, I don't. I don't think that's what I'm not in the Elon Musk camp of Mars, or the kind of Jeff Bezos camp of, you know, we need to get off this planet kind of thing. That's not me. But anyways, I mean, this all the more reason why to underscore the need for bold systemic action. Right. I saw this piece from the, you know, this report about, you know, approaching a tipping point when it comes to these currents, and, you know, kind of read past it initially looking, I was concerned. I didn't originally have it in the show notes until I started seeing what happened with this minimum wage bill, because I think this, you know, that's your direct line right there. You know, these are, we need people who are going to fight. And we need to start pushing our elected officials in order to fight, because we need this bold action. We cannot piss around the edges and kind of shy away from a fight because whatever kind of procedure dictates that, you know, it would make people uncomfortable. I mean, that's not appropriate. Anyway, Sean, anything else you got going on kind of the national score before we head into the break?
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Good. All right, we're gonna head into a quick break, and hopefully that my sound problems are not gonna kind of act up as we shift into our local thing. I want to remind you that you can tune in to Raging Chicken Press on Monday for Out to Coop. I'm not Raging Chicken Press. Out to Coop Live on Monday. We'll be talking to. I'm sorry, man. What is my problem today? I cannot believe what is my problem. Anyways, we'll be talking to Sean O'Leary, a senior researcher from the Ohio River Valley Institute, about you know, basically the failure of fracking as a kind of economic boon as it had been promised. But you can help support this show by going to patreon.com/rcpress. That's patreon.com/rcpress, and become a patron for as little as $5 a month. I'm gonna go reset my brain, and we'll be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day the battle at Bethlehem began. 14,000 workers at Bethlehem Steel's Lackawanna Mill in Buffalo, New York, walked out on strike. The Steel Workers Organizing Committee, or SWOC, had been fighting to organize Little Steel for years. Little Steel was a general term that referred to the smaller mills like Republic, Inland, Bethlehem, and Youngstown Sheet and Tube. At Bethlehem, SWOC was still waiting for a decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals about the company union Bethlehem refused to give up in defiance of the Wagner Act. As a defense industry, Bethlehem had $1.5 billion worth of armament orders to fill, and yet they wouldn't even pay the legal minimum wage mandated for government contracts. Retired steelworker Mitchell Schaefer recalled in a 1991 interview, "I went to work there in the late 30s, swinging a 20-pound sledgehammer to break iron billets." The 81-year-old continued by saying, "I got 40 cents an hour, 6 days a week, no vacations." The last straw came when Bethlehem fired over 1,000 workers. Bethlehem claimed these particular workers damaged coke ovens when they engaged in a work stoppage. Workers immediately formed solid picket lines at 7 gates that stretched 2 miles. They successfully beat back attempts by police to allow scabs to cross their picket line. After 38 hours, Bethlehem quickly agreed to reinstate the 1,000 workers. They soon resumed talks regarding wage increases, grievance procedures, and union recognition. But a month later, Bethlehem decided to go back on their promises. They started organizing elections for collective bargaining representatives through their company union. The stage was set for the next big strike at Bethlehem in March that would finally win union recognition.
And we are back, everybody. It looks like my sound levels are holding, which is like a huge plus. And hopefully we can get that fixed so it won't be a problem in the future. if you got any kind of OBS experts out there and podcast setting up folks that want to kind of chat with me about that, I'd be super, super happy because this has happened now about three or four times where the sound levels just drop off. They're fine and they just drop out. Can't seem to locate the problem. Anyways, I got to stop getting out of my tech head right now because that's what I'm like preoccupied with now. We're back here and in Pennsylvania. And Sean, man, some big, big news when it comes to protecting the climate right here in the Delaware River Basin.
Yes, Delaware River Basin Commission. They permanently banned fracking in the watershed. That's it, like, which is pretty good.
That's the tweet.
they pretty much like cited adverse health effects from fracking waste and on the environment, you know, as reasons why. And yeah, no, it's a great victory. It's been something that's been going on for years now.
So that's just so huge. I mean, the question now at the point is like, you know, is going to have any effect on kind of like PA's policy? I mean, I know that doesn't, you know, obviously we're talking about Delaware River Basin. We're not talking about some of the fracking that's taking place out west, but that's a, you know, a good chunk of kind of the fracking area is going to be taken off the table now.
Yeah. And the reason why this is because we have Democratic governors in Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and Delaware. I mean, this has been an issue for a while, especially with Corbett, who wanted to open up everything to fracking. And I mean, like, I didn't read the report that you're going to be talking about on Monday, but like, you know, we really did lose a whole entire decade of revenue.
Yeah.
We can talk about the effects fracking has on climate and the environment and stuff like that. But, you know, we lost out a whole entire decade of revenue. By letting these drillers go tax-free in Pennsylvania. And we're never going to get this money back.
No, but I mean, not only that, right? I mean, look, here's just...
And like, you know, never going to get this money back. We're never going to get the environmental impacts, the money that needs to be offset to, like, you know, mitigate these impacts and stuff like that. We've gutted the DEP, you know, as like budgetary decisions, like no enforcement of this agency at all in the state. Like, you know, we've swung the doors open, both Republican and Democratic governors,
yep,
for this industry over the past 10 or 12 years. And just like, you know, that, like, it's good to see this victory, but like, it's not going to undo the damage, and like the damage to our budgets and the damage to the environment that it's created over the past decade.
Well, and the kind of what this report says, right? The Ohio River Valley Institute's report comes out and basically shows is that it hasn't delivered on any of the promises, and not even in terms of economic development in the regions where it happens. So here's for an example, this is just kind of a brief part from the report. Between 2008 and 2019, 22 old industrial and rural counties in Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, which make up the Appalachians natural gas region, increased their contribution to the U.S. domestic product, the GDP, by more than one third, right? So those areas, right, that were being fracked, right, contributed significantly by one third, right, to the gross domestic product, right? Big deal, right? In 2008, the 22 counties were responsible for $2.46 of every $1,000 of national output. That's huge. However, during the same period, right, measures of local economic prosperity, the economic impacts of that growth, not only failed to keep pace with the increased share of output, they actually declined. So the 22 counties' share of the national personal income fell by 6.3%. Their share of jobs fell by 7.6%. The share of the nation's population fell by 10.9%, right? So not only did we lose on the tax revenue, right? It actually further, like, increased the economic trauma of these regions, right? So you've got the environmental impact, where people, you know, and then you've got actually people who have found that their prosperity that was promised has actually kind of underdeveloped them as a result of this boom.
I mean, like, this happened with the timber industry. This happened with the coal industry. I mean, this is like the third or fourth time this has happened in the state's history. And you think we would have learned already at this point. But like, you know, like, I mean, there's been people talking about for a while, like if you're a resource extraction economy, it only benefits a handful of people and everyone else gets fucked over in the end. And, you know, this isn't like news. It shouldn't be news to anyone. Like,
well, that's exactly it. You know, and again, this is, you know, I think Tom Wolf had come in and basically wanted to make a bargain with the devil, you know, to try to get this, the tax. Right. But the Republicans in this state, there was no having it. And frankly, let's be honest, right, a kind of a good chunk of Democrats in the state, too, as well, were kind of like, you know, we got to welcome the drillers no matter what. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Right. And so not only did we the only state, right, that has significant amounts of fracking in it, right, that doesn't have like a tax on the drillers. Right. I mean, we're below West Virginia. Way to go. Right, it has notorious like low regulation. We're not gonna take that from the drillers, right? So we're not gonna actually benefit from the economy, and we're gonna kind of like decimate those communities, which is part of a great. That's a great record.
Yeah. So
it's freaking crazy, man. I mean, it's like so this is a huge thing. I mean, so this, you know, this decision basically banning fracking in the Delaware River Basin is enormous. And you know, talking about say direct kind of impacts, but let's be clear, like this is this is a victory, right? But we got a whole way to go, right? In order to kind of like to build back what was taken away. I mean, this has been incredible.
Yeah.
Anyways, so there's like some some temper tantrums going on in the state capital this
Always.
Week on Capitol. Yeah, well, I guess that's nothing new. You're right.
Like, okay, so there's going to be a very important ballot question on the May primary ballot regarding the governor's declaration orders. And this is really a push that's been happening. We've been seeing around throughout the country by like Koch brother organizations and like far right wing think tanks. Commonwealth Foundation is doing the same here in Pennsylvania to limit the emergency powers of governors, declaration emergency powers of governors. And this is mainly a partisan political attack against Governor Wolf. And they're doing this now that can have reverberations, that will have reverberations for decades. Basically, that like what they're saying is like a emergency order can only last for 21 days. This will force the legislature to take actions on this stuff when they are prone to not doing anything. So it'll put a lot of these decisions in the hands of the legislature. And like we know, like disasters just don't end 21 days. Even when it comes to like, you know, flooding or hurricane damage or tornadoes and stuff like that, like this will have a profound impact on the governor's ability, Republican or Democratic, in the future, to handle disasters that are going to be happening more frequently, especially with our climate changing and stuff like that. Like. And this is a response to from the right wing institutions like the Commonwealth Foundation and others as a way of getting back and settling political scores against the governors. We're seeing it in states around the country that have Democratic governors and Republican legislatures. And this will be on the May primary ballot. And so the Department of State this week released a question. It was pretty straightforward. Like saying, do you like laying this argument out and saying, should the governor's ability to declare a declaration, yes or no? Like, should that be taken away from the governor?
Right.
And the Republicans are upset that it was too straightforward.
Yeah, they want to say, like, should the people have the right to be the final determinant of, like, you know, whatever, right? You know, that's what they wanted, like the obscure language that makes it sound
Yeah, and these are the same people who did this a couple years ago with the Supreme Court justices. They changed the age from 70 to 75 because they want to protect a Supreme Court seat on the state legislature. You know, instead of losing a fourth seat in two terms. Like, this is something that, and they had such an obscure fucking question on the ballot that, like, a yes was a no and no was a yes,
right?
Pretty much. So they're upset about this, and, you know, they can just go pound sand.
Yep. There you go.
I mean, anyone reading it, they think it's a leading question, but, like, you know, it explains, like, this is what the emergency powers does and should – the governor lose this ability to do that. I mean, and this is the type of thing where it's extremely hard to stop these from happening. Pennsylvania's had 17 constitutional amendments go through the ballot process, and all 17 have passed. So we don't have a culture of ballot initiatives in the state because of our state constitution. So they're using the constitutional process to change this instead of, like, legislating.
There we go. Well, too bad for them. Too bad for them. I mean, the fight's not over, but you know, at least there's a shot now, I guess.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring. Well, actually, let's talk about this first before. We'll leave that to last. So it'll be the failure to cancel to be the last, because that's just a little fun tease. I wanted to bring this up because we didn't talk about this in the first part of the show, in part because there's, you know, kind of a local connection here that I wanted to kind of bring out, is that if you recall that Joe Biden was at a town hall. What was it, last week? I guess, where he was, or was it this week? God, is it the time? Where he was dismissive of these calls to cancel $50,000 worth of debt. Now, you know, Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren have been out kind of there with a plan supported by folks like AOC and things like this. Bernie Sanders obviously has been kind of behind this, basically to say to immediately cancel $50,000 of debt for every student who's taken out loans in America. Like, that's been the push, right? That has been pretty consistent, and I have to say, strong push from some of the leaders of the Democratic Party, which is great. Biden has been poo-pooing that since from the get-go and saying, no, we want to cancel at least $10,000 worth of debt. But on top of that, right, he wants to have all these kind of like means testing things that would kind of go into that. So in practice, it works out to be some money gets canceled for some people, and you have to figure out, right, if you're one of those people or not. It's kind of like if you want to get the vaccine right now, you know, think about a process like that, right? Or you want to sign up for health insurance through Obamacare, kind of like that, right? You have to figure out whether you qualify. So he came on, he came on this town hall, and he said something which just really pissed me off. Right, because he's saying, look, some of those people with that debt are, like, you know, going to Harvard and these Ivy Leagues, and why should they get the debt forgiveness? You know, why should those people? And trying to do a very poor job at, like, trying to, like ramp up kind of class warfare, right? Or, you know, get the people say, yeah, the rich don't deserve this, when it's the most disingenuous statement that you could possibly make as a justification. Because why? Guess what? The rich people that go to Harvard don't have loans. Right? It's people that are coming from the middle class and working class that make it into those institutions that are burdened the most by the debt. So to claim that if somebody goes to Harvard or someone goes to Princeton or someone goes to Yale, that they shouldn't have their debt canceled, right, because they're going to an elite institution, is basically saying, yeah, the rich people that go to those institutions, they're going to be fine, but we're going to make sure that if they didn't start with means, that we're going to make sure that they're not going to end up with means, because we're going to saddle them with debt for the rest of their lives. That's what that means. It's disgusting, and it is disingenuous in my mind. And for, like, we've talked about this on this program before, is that the only time that programs get massive amounts of support is, like, when they're universal programs, right? And does it matter to me if somebody who is kind of, like, you know, fairly well off might have some of their debt canceled? Absolutely not, right? Why? Because the banks, right, and government policy in the past have produced a crisis and are kind of basically keeping us in debt and preventing like 20-30% of the population, right, from kind of, I don't know, living life, right? This is about stopping the power of the big banks. This is about freeing a generation, and more than a generation, of people who are saddled down with this debt. And it's about justice and about Democrats standing up for everyday people. And, you know, again, I understand to say, look, not everybody goes to college, sure, but you know what? For every student who comes from a working class background, a lower middle class background, or even middle class background, they have parents and they have relatives who have an investment in that kid, right? And they go on to college and to do this stuff. So it matters to them too. Right. And it matters to them that their kid is going to have some kind of opportunity to go for it, and that they're not going to be in a situation where they're going to have to be kind of take on some of that debt, because a lot of them are co-signers to this anyways. you're talking about a significant impact here. And once again, you've got, you know, this kind of consultant based policy making, right? That is about, I don't know, afraid of, like, you know, the Republicans who are going to, you know, cry that Democrats like to spend and doing the wrong thing by people. So I was very happy to find that, you know, Asher Taylor, you may have kind of seen her. She's got, you know, she's been working with the debt collective for a while, kind of arguing for the forgiveness of debt. And frankly, I'm with them. You just cancel all the debt. And basically, Biden would have to use the same authority that they used to put a pause on the kind of the collection of student debt payments, right? They put a pause on that for, because of the pandemic. It's the same authority just to cancel that debt, right? Especially since the federal government is the largest holder of that debt. But locally here, say Kendra Brooks, right? She's a city council member from Philadelphia. Remember, she's like kind of great progressive, kind of like down in Philly. She has joined up with the folks at Debt Collective, and they basically say Biden's telling us a lie. Right. This is and they know it's a lie. This has nothing to do with whether or not it's possible. And it's a lie that, you know, if you go to Harvard or Yale, you don't deserve to have your debt canceled. Right. In Pennsylvania, we're the kind of like second largest percentage of or second largest amount of student debt in the country of states. Right. Our students, the students in this state are kind of going to be impacted kind of like triply by this. Right. And who's it going to impact the worst? Every study shows it's going to impact working class people and people of color the hardest. Right. So this is once again, this is what we're doing. Kendra Brooks is stepping up there and she's kind of joining up with Asher Taylor. Has got a great interview in The Cut, which is kind of from New York Magazine. Do check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes. Great interview with Kendra Brooks. We might be reaching out to her in the kind of in the days to come to get her take on this too as well, because this is like one other thing where we need to be pushing the Biden administration on hard. So kudos to her. All right, Sean, well, it looks like Pat Toomey lives to fight another day before his retirement, I guess.
Yeah, fuck Pat Toomey.
Yeah, well, just to be clear, everybody.
This week, Toomey was facing a censure vote from the Pennsylvania Republican Party because of his the state committee, because of him voting to impeach Donald Trump and convict Donald Trump in the Senate. You know, a lot of Republicans are fucking pissed about this vote. A lot of people after the vote said, you know, we didn't send him to vote his conscience. We sent him there to vote, support Trump, which is like the whole entire thinking of the Republican Party. And it just shows you how off the rails the party has become.
I'll say.
I mean, no, it just, like, you know, it's dangerous thinking. We were talking about this back in the summer when their only plank was to support Donald Trump, but they have no policy decisions.
Right.
Like in their plank, and it was support Trump at all costs. You know, like that's what fascism is in America. Like, and that's what these people still believe. And also,
I'll make this a side note. We can come back to this too, but I forgot to put this in the notes today, but this is also this past week, right? We've got, what's her face? Leslie Bob Rossi, right? Kind of the Trump house woman out kind of Westmoreland.
Oh my
County.
God. We forgot about this.
I know. I can't believe I didn't put it in the notes, right? Is that she, I mean, this
she
is got, kind
she
of
was
like
picked.
Yeah.
She was picked over Mike Reese's widow. Mike Reese, representative, died suddenly, brain aneurysm last month, in his 40s. And the widow was threw her name in consideration for the seat. This is not unprecedented. There was a Democrat who died a couple of years ago. And the Democrat, the widow of that Democrat, I think it's O'Neill was the woman's last name.
Yeah.
Very labor friendly Democrat. She won her seat and she won re-election. You know, like Democrats gave her that seat out of respect. Like this was someone who's been in the legislature for years. You know, this is something you do out of respect if a widow steps forward. And the same thing happened out in Western Pennsylvania with Mike Reese's seat, and the Republican Party said nope and gave it to this fucking Trump grifter.
Yep.
And Reese was pretty conservative to begin with. Reese was part of the leadership team in the Republican caucus, literally just elected leadership, either as like the policy chair or like the caucus secretary, or something like that within the caucus. And They overlooked the widow for his, you know, the widow, like, for this crazy Trump woman who is absolute total Trump grifter. And it just shows you how off the rails the Pennsylvania Republican Party has become writ large. You know, we released that story last week about the county committees and how off the fucking rails they are. And literally, like, the thing I said this week, one of the untold, like, I'll say it again, you know, the untold story about this whole saga over the past several months is that the whole entire party, the National Republican Party, state, local, county, all were involved in the insurrection. You know, planning and sending people to trips, yep, and organizing these buses, challenging the results of the election. You know, the whole entire institutional rot of the Republican Party is just 100% for Trump. And this fever is not going to break anytime soon. And this is just the latest showcasing of it.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen the pictures of it, I mean, do check out some of the articles. I will put the link in the show notes, even though I forgot to kind of say it up top. But she literally painted a house, this gigantic, like, flag thing with this kind of huge Trump thing. People would stop by this house to kind of take pictures and things. And she's, you know, basically the election was stolen, that we've got to stop the fascist governor, Tom Wolf, right, who's taken away emerge. I mean, all that kind of nonsense. So anyways, that brings us back to Pat Toomey. So Pat Toomey, so despite the fact, is what's going on.
Yeah, and they were going to vote to censure him. The vote never happened. The meeting was running into technical glitches on Zoom, and they just, like, decided not to do it.
Decided not to do it. That's great.
But yeah, like, it's just absolutely insane what the Republican Party is doing, and they're still just going down this road, and they're not stopping anytime soon. The fever is never going to break.
It's never going to break, folks. It's like, and we never have to hope. I mean, you know, how many times we got to say it, right? We got to fight like hell right now. We got to go big. We got to go hard, and cannot wait around in hopes that some good Republicans are going to take it up, right? Like Nancy Pelosi said a couple of weeks back, right? She said, we need a strong Republican Party. No, we need a Republican Party that is decimated right now, because it is inhabited by grifters, and is inhabited by conspiracy theorists, is inhabited by people who want to do us harm. So there we have it. Another somber note to start on. All right, anything else you got going on in PA, Sean?
That's pretty much it.
That's pretty much it.
On a happy note.
On a happy note. Right, there you go. All right, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We're going to be back right after this with this week's, you know what it is. That's right. This week's Last Call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back, everybody. This is Raging Chicken's Out to Coup podcast. It's our last call. We talk beer news, talk space news, everything else that's kind of going around, going on in our lives. This week, big news in space news. A big week in space news, everybody. I mean, yes, the Mars Perseverance rover sent back images of the landing from the February 18th landing in Jezero crater on Mars. And I got to say, I've probably watched that 25, 30 times. It is absolutely incredible to see the process of seeing kind of the landing process on Mars, to see Mars kind of happen, to see, you know, I've watched all the computer models that NASA has kind of shown us, kind of like, you know, the renditions of what it's supposed to happen, to see actual live color, high def footage of this being executed is astonishing to me. And I know I've said this before, but it's incredible to me that, you know, the lander was supposed to land on Mars at 3:55 p.m. and it landed on Mars at 3:55 p.m. right? Like, I mean, on schedule. And, you know, and again, I made this comment last week, but it's like, you know, we can't get an electrical power grid to work in Texas, but we can land a lander on Mars in, you know, at, like on time. You know, I mean, it just, I mean, it goes to show you in so many different ways that it has nothing to do with the kind of the capacity. This has everything to do with will, right? What we choose to do, right? And what we can do. So everything that's happened, the decimation that we see happen in Texas, the decimation that we saw because of COVID is by choice. Sean, do you have something breaking?
I am looking at the CPAC videos that are going in.
Oh my God. Has it started already?
They are rolling. Yeah, it's this weekend. They are rolling.
No, I thought it started later this afternoon, but oh my God.
I'm not sure, but like they are rolling a golden fucking statue of Trump.
No way. You're kidding me.
I am not kidding you. This is from last night. A golden fucking statue of Trump. So Bill Kristol and others like were tweeting out pictures of Baal or Baal, like the people worshiping Baal at like in from the Bible. And I thought it was just like a metaphor.
Oh my God.
I sang you the like. Yeah, it's just like
you sent it to me. I got to look at this because, like, I'll tell you, yeah, I've been actually looking forward to this in this really like awful way because I'm actually let me put it this way, is that I remember back in the lead up to the 2016 election, I spent, you know, when the CPAC during then and then afterwards, I spent some time watching it, right? Because just to try to get a handle on what was coming out of these people's mouths, right? Because, you know, they're unabashed at CPAC, right? You know, and they stream it, they stream the stuff live. And
did you see like the one, or go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and so this is what I remember, like watching Steve Bannon's entire, like his entire talk at CPAC back in 2016, or might've been 2017 after the election, because it seemed to have such resonance and importance for what's going on. And right now this CPAC conference, right, I think is going to show us the crazy. Right, I think we're actually going to see the directions. And when I was talking to Jordan Hopkins on Wednesday, you know, saying, look, the Patriot Party is one of these directions might go, but I think we're going to see some of these tendencies all on display in CPAC in here. So that's going to be absolutely fascinating. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
There was a photo going around like a CPAC from a couple years ago with Ali Alexander, Jack Posobiec, and a couple of other like right-wing grifters all sitting next to each other, and all of them were involved in the insurrection. And just like, look at the arc of where these people went. Like, and it's so fucking true.
Yeah, but, and then, also to go with the golden statue, also the CPAC organizers were getting booed by people in the crowd because they were being asked to comply with hotel rules and wear masks. Yeah, and they started yelling, freedom! Instead, right? So there you go. You got the kind of idolatry and the kind of insanity all working together already. Oh God. Oh my God. Oh, okay. I'm looking at the statue now. That is insane.
Well, like the reason why I just saw this because I was like browsing on Twitter as you start talking about your space stuff. And I saw Bart Simpson was trending. And I was like, why the fuck is Bart Simpson?
Oh my god! Oh my god! All right, all right, all right. Back to space stuff. We're gonna have an update on CPAC stuff next week. I guarantee it, because the crazy is gonna be on full display. It's already on display pretty clearly. If you haven't seen the picture yet, I mean, if you look at the golden statue of Trump, it's like not like a Greek god statue of Trump kind of thing, right?
Like standing, a fucking cartoon up, character.
It's like a cartoon character Trump with like Apollo Creed shorts on. It's pretty funny.
Throw in the towel.
Right, exactly. Exactly. It looks like exactly.
Throw the damn towel.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh my god, it's killing me. Oh god. Well, so that was pretty amazing this week. The Perseverance rover, he had that, and then they also released the first 360-degree panoramic view of what the rover sees, what Perseverance sees on the ground. And again, it just the first ever high def full color thing, it's just remarkable. So this is going to have, I think this is resonating in kind of ways that I have not heard of, like the space stuff resonating in other ways. I had like students of mine, for example, totally charged up about it. There were watch parties that were going on, online watch parties that were going on about this. They had did great work ahead of time, kind of working with, kids across the world, asking questions, and it's just been really fascinating. In other news, there's also, I think, boosted in part by what's going on here with the Mars landing. You've got some researchers have been working on space, like nuclear-powered space propulsion systems for rockets. And there's like this long tube version of a reactor that they've got this nuclear fuel that would be kind of compacted in these really small containers that are, it's supposed to be more stable and also the kind of stuff we shall see. But it's interesting enough to see that already that you're seeing pushes to see like how else you're going to kind of get to Mars more quickly. Right. So it's pretty crazy. And also I mentioned, I'll talk about this next week because I want to give it some space to talk about the space hotel that's going to be going up, which will be interesting. The other news that's kind of, I put it in the last call today. It was actually my friend Niels, alerted me to this. His partner is, kind of lead brewer of Narragansett, brewery out in Providence, Rhode Island. And, hopefully in the weeks to come, we're going to have her on, to talk about some, kind of a brewery and, basically the brewing industry and labor issues, right. Is kind of like what we got at the forefront. And so he sent me this one here to a Molson Coors beverage company. Just locked out 300 workers in a Toronto brewery after the workers overwhelmingly rejected the company's like best and final offer. Like 17 people voted to take it. And then the rest of them were like, no, there's no way we're taking it. And really what's at stake in that labor struggle was the attempt by the company, and this, we see this over and over again, is to institute a two-tier wage system, right? Just basically saying, okay, if you've been here for so many years, right, you can kind of retire and you get this thing. However, everyone else that we knew gets hired, right, they're going to get paid less, right, and they're going to lose any rights to a pension. Right. And these workers are standing together and saying, no, we're not going to sell off the next generation. Right. Just to kind of protect ourselves. We're going to stand tall. We're going to stand together. And this, they've been without a contract since December 31st. And they were in negotiations. I think that the lockout came at a little bit of a surprise to some of the union negotiators who were like, we didn't expect this, in part because it seemed like we were making some progress in some discussions. But then they started finding out that actually they had posted job ads for scabs like 3 weeks before this had happened, right? They were waiting for this cooling off period and for a ruling to come forward from a Canadian Canadian board. And then as soon as that ruling came through, boom, they dropped the axe and locked out the workers and started bringing in scabs, even though they're not saying officially if they've hired these folks, but it looks like there's other people coming in. So put back that Molson. Like, first, if you're drinking Coors to begin with, you got bigger problems than I can imagine, right?
My dad drinks Coors.
It's run Coors by a freaking like Nazi sympathizer. So I mean, kind of like the Great White North, dude, or West, I should say, because it's Colorado. But whatever, the Coors are just horrible people, and but now they're all one kind of Molson Coors. If you're a fan of Molson, if you're a fan of Coors, do not buy them, right, until they, and send them some messages, make sure that they could, that they stop locking those workers out and get back to negotiating. That's what we're all about. So good. So Sean, you know, to get off the beer tip a little bit, you know, you've been up to some monkey business from what I understand.
Yeah, I've been trying some different whiskeys lately. My go-to is Knob Creek bourbon. Just
great.
It's easy drinking. I've been also trying a bunch of different scotch lately. So, you know, one of the things is called Monkey Shoulder. And what that is, it's a blended malt scotch, which means it's a it's blended. It's a blended scotch from three different distilleries. It's a Speyside scotch. It's not like peated or anything. It has like a really nice, clean, super clean taste to it. And it's all barley, so it's single. So it's a barley scotch. No other like grains are in it. It's super good, super nice. Smooth, clean. I think there's a hole in the bottle. Yeah, I think there's a hole in the bottle.
Watch for those leaks.
Yeah, because like it's been
the whiskey's great, but their packaging is like a little sketchy. So
suspect.
It's that good, huh?
it's that good. I've been watching some like whiskey reviews online to see like different things I have to try.
Yeah,
like. I love McAllen's 10, but that's a super expensive bottle. It's like, well, it's expensive for me. It's $70 a bottle, and it's like,
wow,
not going to spend that like on a whiskey. Like my top range, like upper limits is Knob Creek. I'll spend $30-$32 on a bottle, but usually like it's Knob or Bullet is what I go with. Also love Bullet Rye and Knob Rye, like. So I've been trying like the whole entire gamut of things the past year, but like I can't get into the peated smoky stuff yet. Like I'm just not there, and I don't want to spend like that much money on a bottle for something I'm not going to enjoy drinking.
Yeah, and it really, but you know the thing is, I will have to say is that you know the benefit of some of that stuff is the bottle lasts a long time. Right. The packaging is very good. The bottles do not leak.
For instance, like right now, I have a bottle of Knob Creek, like one of their like signature ryes that they put out, like signature whiskeys every year.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is like, it's 127 proof single barrel rye. The fact that it's like 127, I can't like, I just can't fucking deal with it.
Yeah.
Like it's a sipper, but it's also, it's one of those things. It's like, you're not drinking that every night. Like, that's my special occasion whiskey.
Yeah.
Like when something good happens, I was going to debate like having a shot for Rush and I was like, nah, I'll just, you know, go to the regular.
You took that one, you put it back in the gun cabinet.
Yeah.
Lock it up. Keep it safe. Hide the keys from yourself.
Rush wasn't worth pouring one out for that.
No.
So, but no, I've been cutting back on the beer a lot over the past couple months. And
Sean's working on his beach bod.
Nothing
but whiskey.
Yeah, mainly because it's like lower calories, lower carbs and stuff like that. It's healthy.
we're gonna see you in no time. You're gonna have to there, you're gonna be like sipping your whiskey, kind of like sunbathing on the banks of the Susquehanna.
It's pretty much.
Yeah, exactly.
And then also, like, you know, I haven't smoked in like 4 months, 3 months now. So it's kind of like saving a lot of money on that end.
There you go. Sock it away. Right.
Yeah.
We need it. We're all going to need it, I think. Well, cool. I got a couple of things from Free Will. One, they have the Sputnik 36. And I kind of fumbled this a little bit last week just because I didn't have the full one in here. But Sputnik 36, I had the Sputnik 35 at home, but they've been putting out these different versions of it. But this is a dry Irish stout brewed with a base of flake barley, roasted barley, and midnight wheat. It's fermented with one of their favorite kind of English strains here. It's a true, this is now I'm reading for their stuff. It's true Sputnik fashion. Made some slight adjustments to our old standard William to get as close as we could to the perfect little stout. But for fans of the Nitro line staple and one of our earliest bottle offers, this fresh take will hopefully become a new daily drinker for these late winter months. Notes of dusty cocoa, subtle coffee, and dark roast coming in at a nice stout level of that 4.3 ABV, right? So it's not kind of like one of these big, kind of imperial stouts. It's kind of a nice kind of a dry, you know, Irish stout, looking like you look at Guinness or something like this, right? Pretty good. Their big news that they've been pushing out this week, though, is that they've got their first like Ralphius alternative bourbon barrel aged stout coming out tomorrow, Saturday, February 27th, and that's going to be available both in Perkasy and Peddler's Village tap rooms, as well as on their online store, right? You can have it shipped anywhere, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Washington, D.C., and they come in these little cans, right? 8.4 ounces, little cans, right? Tiny ones. Why would you say? Well, let me read a little bit here. So this one is called Soul Supper. It's an imperial stout aged with bourbon barrels, chilies, cacao. How do you say that, Sean? I always say that wrong. Cacao?
Cacao.
Well, I think it's cacao. Yeah. Cacao. So cacao nibs, cinnamon, cumin, star anise, and milk sugar. This is now I'm going to read from them. They took their brand new extra long boiled stout base designed to be luxuriously thick and chewy and aged it in several bourbon barrels with a grocery list of worth of ingredients. First, ground chilies brought home from New Mexico, small mountains worth of organically produced fair direct trade Ecuadorian cacao, hand selected for them from their friends at Naked Chocolate, cinnamon sticks, a couple of star anise pods per barrel. And sometime they added a whole dried guajillo and ancho chilies, which they were rehydrated and toasted, and they are carefully dosed with cumin power to the equation, right? And that was thanks for a good tip from the folks at Trey Locally Sourced. And that's all the stuff that goes in this. And as I said, it almost ends in the kind of like, you know, you get some heat, you get some semi-chocolate sweet pudding kind of taste, they say. And it's their highest gravity beer ever produced, meaning dangerously consumable as you process each sip at 13.5 ABV. So there's a reason for the little cans, everybody. So that one is actually going out. So they're going out as a special shipment. So that's their kind of big announcement this week. If you want to come and check that out, you can certainly do that. Just go check out the Free Will Brewing store.
And,
I remember when
Oscar Blues put out their Bourbon Barrel 1050 in like 22-ounce cans. they were just amazing.
Oh, yeah.
like 20 ounce cans or something like that.
Yeah. That was I remember the first time I got Ralphius. In kind of one of the big bomber bottles, right? And kind of like, you know, let's sit down and have a couple of Ralphius, right?
The last time I had a Ralphius was when the Eagles won the Super Bowl, and I was drunk already at that point.
Oh my god!
And I opened up a Ralphius. Let's just say the next morning was really bad. Brain splitting, yes. Like hangover that no amount of like Tylenol could like take away.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, I'm really glad that they started kind of like canning.
Small amounts cans?
Yeah. I mean, and small bottles of it too as well. Because it's really, you know, if you're not familiar with it, if you're not familiar with like a beer with that kind of like pack, like that kind of punch
knocks you on your ass.
No, it really does, because it's so good. I mean, it's so freaking good. But holy cow. But anyways, you want to get kind of a little taste of that, you can go to freewillbrewing.store. They will kind of, you hit that $85, is it still 85 bucks? Yeah, $85 amount. They'll ship it to you for free. Got to be 21 and over, obviously, but they will ship to anywhere in Pennsylvania, Virginia, Washington, D.C. Or you can just kind of order online and pick it up at the store. They're even bring it out to the car for you if you want. So that's what I got, Sean. Anything else for the good of the order?
No, that's pretty much it.
All right, man. Well, hey, everybody, thank you for sticking with us today. And I apologize for the kind of little rough start today of getting caught in some technical stuff. It's like one of these ongoing little glitches that shows up here. It's like the little kind of gremlins in the machine, so to speak. But, you know, if you're still with us, still watching us on YouTube right now, make sure you hit that like button. Make sure you subscribe and make sure you kind of give us some love by hitting that bell. Every time we go live, you can become a kind of patron of this, help support our work by going to patreon.com/RCPress. And, you know... We'll see you on Monday, right? Out to Coop Live on Monday. You'll be there with Sean O'Leary, senior researcher of the Ohio River Valley Institute. Till then, everybody, have a good one. I'm going to go kind of like collect my thoughts. See ya!
Future. No.